After leaving the museum, Anya made her way across the city, intent on checking into the Hotel Apollinaire. As planned, she asked for Suzette when she arrived at the registration desk, and was quickly shuffled over to the cute, blonde-haired woman who was now waiting on her under the name Stefan had picked out, Allison Smith.
Ah, Stefan's special guest. A pleasure to have you with us, Miss Smith. And if there is anything I can do during your stay, please do not hesitate to ask.
It took Anya a moment to read between the lines. Suzette thought she was sleeping with Stefan and was here for a wild weekend of illicit romance, hence the special guest comment. Anya thought about correcting her, but swiftly decided against it. Stefan, she knew, had a reputation as a bit of a player, and if the staff wanted to think he was trying to impress his latest conquest with a suite at the hotel, so be it.
Do you have a package waiting for me?
It took only a few minutes for the bellhop to bring it to her while she waited at the desk. Anya felt a definite sense of relief once the torque was back in her hands. The chances of the package having been intercepted by her pursuers were so minuscule as to be astronomical, especially when you factored in her use of the name Stefan chose for her on the mailing label. But that hadn't stopped her from worrying about it. Her room turned out to be a gorgeous suite on the second floor of the hotel. From the balcony outside her bedroom, she could see the Montparnasse Cemetery. She knew a number of important historical figures were buried there, including Frédéric Bartholdi, the sculptor of the Statue of Liberty, and Paul Deschanel, a former president of France. She ordered room service, ate a leisurely meal for the first time in what felt like weeks, and then drew herself a hot bath. Soaking in the warm water, she tried to make sense of her most recent attackers. The men who broke into her hotel room in London seemed to have been looking for something, the torque, as much as they were looking for her. But what would an avowed terrorist group want with a 2,000-year-old necklace? Her meeting with Deschamps might have provided her with the answer to that very question. Deschamps had scoffed at the legends surrounding the torque, that whoever wore it in battle would never suffer defeat at the hands of his or her enemies. After all, magic wasn't real, right? The idea that the torque had some kind of mystical power was simply absurd. At an earlier point in her life, Anya might have agreed, but no longer. After all, she carried a sword that once belonged to Joan of Arc, and that could appear and disappear at will. Never mind the fact that one of the primary missions in the life of her friend and part-time mentor, Rue, was hunting down such artifacts and safeguarding them from the wrong hands. What if this was one of those kinds of artifacts? What if the legends surrounding the torque were true? It might help to explain why a terrorist group like the Red Hand Defenders was interested in it, to start. The truth was, there wasn't much that could be done with a 2,000-year-old necklace, aside from selling it on the black market. Sure, the money obtained by doing so might finance a number of operations to support the group's cause, but there were easier ways of obtaining money. But if the necklace gave you power over your enemies, then it became a far more valuable prize, one for which a group like the RHD would willingly kill. It explained so much. Clearly, the RHD was playing for keeps.
I'm up against these guys and I don't know anything about them.
Doug had explained it was an Irish terrorist group, but that was it. If she was going to have to defend the Torque from their repeated attempts to gain control of it, she needed to learn more.
Know your enemy and know yourself, and your victory will never be in doubt. Thank you, Sun Tzu.
As Anya was digging into the beliefs and goals of the Red Hand Defenders, Rue was activating the video conferencing program on his computer that would connect him to Shaw and the other members of the artifact group. The 72 hours were up. It was time for the auction to end. Shaw wasted no time getting to business.
72 hours ago, I placed the Tear of the Gods, a one-of-a-kind Celtic torque once worn by Queen Boudicca herself, up for auction among you. Despite some furious bidding, we have a winner.
Having submitted his final bid just moments before, Rue leaned forward in anticipation, while on the screen, Shaw's smile grew wider and phonier, if that was at all possible.
The final bid was for $6 million.
Rue turned away, no longer interested in hearing the rest. His bid had not been that high, which meant the torque was going to one of the other five. He'd have to have Henshaw look into it, see if he could ferret out who had been the final bidder. With that information in hand, he could decide how he wanted to proceed. There were, after all, other ways of acquiring the artifact. As had become his habit, Rue listened to Shaw prattle on for 10 more minutes and then remained on the line after the others disconnected, clandestinely listening in on the events taking place in Shaw's office, hoping to hear something useful. This time, his diligence paid off. When dealing with Vanguard business, Shaw would normally have his secretary initiate his calls, so when Rue heard him dialing the phone himself, it perked his attention.
Is the package ready?
Of course. You may take delivery whenever you like.
To Rue, it sounded like Shaw was obviously preparing to take control of the torque from whatever third-party agents he'd hired to seize it.
Tonight, then. There is a park just south of the Pont Louis-Philippe on the Quai de Bourbon.
I know it.
10 o'clock. Use the signal from our previous meeting.
The conversation over, the two men hung up. Rue felt his adrenaline rise. By intercepting the delivery, he'd have a chance to secure the torque for himself without having to pay the $6 million price tag currently attached to it. Never mind that he'd be screwing Shaw over in the process. That alone made it worth his while.
Sanctimonious little cockroach.
His mood soaring at the idea, Rue was about to break the connection when he heard Shaw address someone in the room with him.
You heard?
Yes.
Then you understand how important it is that you finish this now.
Yes, sir. I'll take care of it personally.
You'd better. She'll be at this address in the morning.
The rustle of a piece of paper let Rue know something changed hands.
Recover my property, and then get rid of her.
What about the geologist?
Get rid of him, too.
Consider it done.
After another few seconds, the connection went dead, indicating that Shaw had powered down his computer. Rue didn't know who they were talking about, but it was clear that good things were not in store for whoever it was. No matter. He had other things to worry about, like how to steal the Tear of the Gods right out from under Shaw's nose. He pressed the intercom on his desk.
Henshaw, a word, please.
A minute passed, maybe two, and then his majordomo stepped into the room. The former SAS officer had a strained look on his face, and he moved directly to the television set in the corner.
I think you should have a look at this, sir.
On the screen, a short man in an ill-fitting suit stood on the steps of New Scotland Yard, an array of television reporters and their ever-present microphones thrust in front of him. Rue was reminded of vultures waiting for their kill to finally fall over and die before moving into feast. Unfortunately for them, this particular police detective still had plenty of fight left in him. He stood there, staring them down, until silence fell and he could hear himself speak without shouting over the clamor.
I'll make a statement and answer a few questions.
Why on earth, Henshaw? Am I watching a London newscast?
The whereabouts of Anya Creed are still uncertain.
Rue immediately gave the man his full attention.
The investigation into what happened in the West Midlands continues. We have several leads, though I am not at liberty to discuss those with you at this time. Suffice to say that we now believe we understand the motives for the attack and intend on bringing the perpetrators to justice as swiftly as possible.
Attack? Just what has Anya gotten herself into this time?
Is Miss Creed still a suspect, Inspector?
Not at this time. We are still very much interested in speaking with Miss Creed, but as a witness rather than a suspect. If anyone has information on her whereabouts, we urge you to call the hotline, as her life may be at risk.
A telephone number appeared at the bottom of the screen, and Rue absently memorized it. Then he muted the television.
Henshaw, do you know what is going on?
No, caught it while flipping channels, sir. I had no idea Miss Creed was in trouble, or I would have brought it to your attention earlier.
Rue nodded. Henshaw had been with him for years. His loyalty was unquestionable. That didn't tell him what was going on, however.
I wonder why she didn't call.
Perhaps she has, sir.
Realizing, as Henshaw knew he would, that he hadn't checked his cell phone for several days, perhaps even as long as a week, Rue fished it out of his desk and stared at the display. The icon indicating that he had voicemail messages stared back at him.
Ah, merde.
He tapped the keys and listened to the messages one at a time. The first was inconsequential, a business matter from one of his many managers that didn't really need his immediate attention. He'd deal with it later. The second and third messages, however, were from Anya. In the first, she sounded mildly harried, but otherwise okay. It was the second call that disturbed him. She was clearly stressed, and didn't sound like she was thinking too clearly. The log on his phone said the call had come in the previous day. She sounded hunted. His cell phone failed to capture the number from which her calls originated, so he called up his address book and tried to reach her.
This voicemail box is full. Please try again at another time.
Rue hung up and considered his next move. If he was going to help her, he needed to understand what was going on first.
Henshaw, get me everything you can on whatever incident it is he's talking about. I want to know it all. Who, what, where, when, you name it.
Very good, sir.
And while you're at it, figure out who this joker is as well.
Rue pointed at the figure of Detective Inspector Beresford as he turned away from the microphones.
He's looking for Anya. I want to know what he intends to do if he finds her.
Henshaw nodded and then slipped out of the room. Henshaw and Rue arrived at the rendezvous more than an hour early, wanting to be in position long before the primary targets arrived at the scene. Henshaw parked the car several blocks away in the heart of a local neighborhood and exited the vehicle, carrying a long leather case in one hand. Rue waited for a time, then got out of the car himself, heading off in the other direction. The delay would minimize their chances of being seen and remembered by a nosy resident. Reaching the steps that led up into the parking lot, Rue settled himself into place and began to wait. After centuries of practice, he was good at waiting. David Shaw arrived at the designated meeting area shortly before 10 that night. The park was empty, no other cars in sight. He pulled to the very end of the lot and turned his vehicle around, facing back toward the entrance in case he needed to make a quick departure. He'd done business with Perchenko several times in the past and had no reason to suspect the man might double-cross him, but it never hurt to be prepared. The device itself was valuable, as were the codes to the accounts Shaw would be using to transfer the purchase price directly to Perchenko. And there were the Libyans to consider. If they had convinced Perchenko that their patronage was more important than his own, it simply meant that Shaw hoped the handover would go smoothly, but if it did not, he was prepared to deal with it. After all, he hadn't reached his current position through brilliance alone. He'd done his time on the streets, had more than enough blood on his hands to hold his own, even against the former Russian commando. Shaw's thoughts turned to Jackson and the events set to play out in the morning. The torque was the key. Without it, the package he was planning to pay Perchenko so handsomely for would be about as useful as a eunuch in a brothel. He didn't understand why Jackson was having such difficulty with the task. How formidable could the woman be, for heaven's sake? Perhaps she'd simply been lucky so far. A car turned into the parking lot. Shaw tensed, waiting for the signal, but it never came. The other car simply used the space to pull a U-turn, its lights washing over Shaw's vehicle at the back of the lot, but not really seeing him at all. Seconds later, the car was gone. Relaxing once more, Shaw's thoughts turned to what would happen once he had both Perchenko's device and the torque in hand. The goals of the Red Hand defenders were simple: to throw off the yoke of British rule and to set up a free Irish Republic across the entire breadth of Ireland, constituted under Irish rule. They were the same goals that the Provisional Irish Republican Army had fought to achieve, the same goals that had been swept aside for political expediency in the wake of the Belfast Agreement in 1998. Shaw, a young soldier in the cause at the time, had been appalled by the agreement and privately vowed he would never accept such conditions. When the PIRA announced an end to the armed conflict and went so far as to decommission their weapons in 2005, Shaw made good on that vow. He'd spent the years since the Belfast Agreement doing everything he could to be certain any decision he made with regard to the cause would be well-funded. To that end, he created the Vanguard Group and built it into a multi-million-dollar conglomerate of companies whose primary mission was to simply make money for the cause. By the time the decommissioning was announced, Shaw had both the connections and the funding to continue the fight on his own terms. The Red Hand Defenders were born. In the years since, his agency became responsible for taking the fight to the enemy in a way that would have made his old mates proud. They'd been responsible for 8 successful bombings, including the deaths of 3 high-profile targets, as well as 2 shooting sprees that forced the British and Irish governments to sit up and take notice. Still, all that was nothing compared to what he intended to carry out next. This time, it wouldn't be just the British government paying attention. This time, he would capture the eyes of the world. Then, he would make his demands. The Red Hand Defenders would no longer be considered a second-class organization, and the demands of the true loyalists amid the Irish people would finally be heard. It would be a glorious day indeed. His reverie was broken by the arrival of another vehicle. He watched as it stopped only a few feet into the parking lot, facing his direction. The lights flashed twice, quickly, and then once more.
Oh.
Shaw repeated the signal. Perchenko had arrived. He waited as the other vehicle, a Land Rover, approached, watching it come to a stop just a few feet away. When it had, he got out of the car. Across from him, the Russians did the same. Perchenko had a bodyguard with him, which wasn't unexpected. He'd brought one along at the last meet as well. Shaw remembered the Russian joking that the man's name was Insurance. After all, that was his purpose. Shaw hadn't found it all that amusing. He waited for the two men to join him.
Good to see you again.
You have the money?
Of course. You have my package?
Perchenko turned and flicked a hand at his companion. As the other man led the way to the back of the vehicle, Perchenko and Shaw followed. The bodyguard opened up the rear of the vehicle, revealing what was stored there. It was a dark gray metallic case, about the size of a typical footlocker. The designation RA-115 was stamped on the top of the case in white letters. At a nod from Perchenko, the other man stepped forward, unlocked the 2 clasps that held the container closed, and then lifted the lid before stepping back out of the way. Shaw moved forward, looking at but not touching the device. What looked to him to be a large artillery shell rested in the center of the case, with 2 square objects on either side that he assumed were the neutron generators. A 4th item, a rectangular device about the size of a hardcover book, sat in the upper right-hand corner of the case and had several wires running out of it and over to the rear of the artillery shell.
It is operational?
Nah.
Shaw knew the other man had to be lying. Smuggling the shell of a Soviet-era tactical nuclear device out of the Ukraine was one thing. Doing so with an accompanying load of weapons-grade plutonium was something else entirely. As far as he was concerned, the shell was good enough. He would get the necessary plutonium from a different source. He gave no indication that he knew the truth about the device.
Very good. You have the account number?
Perchenko handed him a slip of paper with an account number comprised of 18 letters and numbers. Shaw knew without asking that it was the number of a Swiss bank account. With the other 2 men watching, Shaw took out his phone and used a mobile banking application to initiate a transfer of funds from an account he'd set up under a false name for just this purpose into the account Perchenko gave him. The transfer took 5 minutes. No one said anything while they waited. When finished, Perchenko gave his companion another signal. The big man moved the tactical nuclear device from the back of the Land Rover to the trunk of Shaw's Mercedes. Just like that, the exchange was done. Rue watched the entire exchange from his concealed position on the stairs leading up to ground level. The pair of miniature binoculars he held in his hands had been designed by a high-tech firm to his exact specifications. They were the best money could buy. Thanks to the way the Russian parked, they allowed him to see directly into the back of the vehicle. One thing was for certain, that case was not built to house the Tear of the Gods. While he couldn't see directly into it, it was clear from its weight alone that it couldn't be the Torque. The big Russian's arm muscles bulged when he'd lifted it, and Rue estimated it probably weighed a good 50 to 75 pounds. The back of the Mercedes dropped an inch closer to the ground when the case landed inside. So if it wasn't the torque, what was it? For a moment, Rue considered just walking away. His interest was in the torque, and this clearly wasn't it, so why get involved? But something made him hesitate. While he didn't recognize the Russian, he'd seen his type before. The man was clearly a former soldier, a trait easy to see in the way he held himself, in the way he scanned the surrounding area on a regular basis, searching for threats. His presence begged the question, what was something like that doing with a guy like Shaw? Something wasn't right here. Rue could feel it in his bones. Something told him he needed to find out what was in that case. As he was mentally debating the situation, Shaw said some final comment to the Russian and then got into his car and drove off. With his options dwindling, Rue touched the microphone at his throat.
Now!
He rushed up the stairs, heading directly for the two men standing near the Land Rover.
Intruders!
The man shoved a hand inside his jacket, no doubt going for his pistol. That was as far as he got. A dart struck him in the side of the neck, knocking him backward against the vehicle. The gun he was reaching for clattered to the ground beside him. The other man was still reaching for the gun at his back when the second dart from Henshaw's rifle struck him in the shoulder. Rue was close enough by that time to see the red fletching on the end of the dart, and he drew himself up short at the sight, expecting the other man to go down, just as his companion had. Unfortunately, he didn't. As the other man shook his head, trying to clear it, Rue realized what must have gone wrong. The darts were calibrated with enough tranquilizers to knock down your average human being, but this man's size must have diluted the dose. Rue had hundreds of years of fighting experience at his disposal, and if there was one thing he had learned, it was never give your opponents the opportunity to do you harm.
Oh, well.
So, as the big man shook himself and seemed to bring his attention back into focus, Rue stepped up and, without pausing, delivered a smashing kick to the man's groin. The big Russian's eyes rolled back in his head, and he toppled over like a sack of bricks. Rue didn't waste any time. He grabbed the now unconscious bodyguard and hefted him into the back of the Land Rover, then did the same with the other man. When they were both inside the vehicle, Rue closed the rear doors and then took a moment to look around. As far as he could tell, no one had seen what had just happened. He touched the mic again.
I'm headed for the rendezvous point. See you there.
Roger that.
The keys to the Land Rover were still in the ignition. Rue started the car and drove smoothly out of the parking lot. From start to finish, the entire assault had taken less than 3 minutes.
I've still got it.
Half an hour later, Rue sat in a chair in the living room of an isolated farmhouse in rural France, waiting for the man in the chair across from him to wake up. The man's driver's license identified him as Ivan Perchenko. Rue didn't have any idea whether that was the man's real name or an alias, but in truth, it really didn't matter. All Rue wanted from the man was some information, and for that, a name wasn't necessary. The man's partner, name unknown since he hadn't carried any identification, was in the garage outside, tied securely with a thick piece of rope. Henshaw watched over him. If they couldn't get what they wanted out of Perchenko, they'd turn their attention to the bodyguard. For now, though, they'd start at the top. After sitting there for several minutes, Rue watched the man stir and then come to full consciousness. It was like watching a lizard wake up. 1 minute they were completely asleep, the next they were watching you with those cold reptilian eyes, gauging just how much of a threat you might be. Rue intended to pass the test. On the table next to him, in full view of his captive, lay an assortment of devices designed to make Perchenko think twice about what lay ahead for him. A small sledgehammer, an electric drill, a hand drill, several different types of saws, a pair of metal snips, a handheld blowtorch, and wire for gelding. Rue didn't have any immediate intention of using them. They were just there to provide Perchenko with the proper motivation to answer his questions. If Perchenko refused to do so, Rue knew he'd have to reconsider their use. But for now, they would remain where they were. Perchenko's gaze flicked across the table, taking in the objects arranged there, and then moved around the room, assessing his options. Rue waited. He He wasn't in any hurry. Finally, the man's attention returned to him.
I have a few questions for you. It would be easier for you if you simply answered them.
You do not frighten me, old man.
I wouldn't expect them to frighten you, Mr. Pachenko. I know your background. I know that you are capable of resisting for quite some time.
Pachenko was a soldier. Most modern soldiers were trained in anti-interrogation techniques. Eventually, he would talk. Everyone did. But he was likely to resist Rue's efforts for several hours, and that wasn't something Rue wanted to wait around for.
But whether they frighten you or not is completely irrelevant to the pain they will cause. And pain is never a pleasant experience.
He reached out, picked up the blowtorch, and saw Pachenko flinch slightly from the corner of his eye.
So, let's make this easy for both of us.
Rue put the tool back down on the tabletop.
I desire some information. I have no doubt that you have the information I'm looking for. So let's make this a business arrangement. I will ask my questions, and I will pay you for your answers.
The Russian stared at him blankly for a moment.
Pay me?
Rue smiled. Maybe this would be easier than he thought.
For every question you answer to my satisfaction, I'll give you $10,000.
$10,000 is nothing.
Well, that would depend on how many questions I ask, wouldn't it?
With the Russian considering the offer, Rue sweetened the pot.
I'm not interested in any of your other clients, nor am I looking for you to betray any confidences about them. All I want to know about is your meeting with Shaw.
Shaw?
Do we have a deal?
How do I know he will keep your word?
You don't. You can either take a chance and earn some money for your troubles, or go back to the first alternative. Either way, I'll find out what I need to know.
Pachenko really didn't have much choice, and he knew it, too. After another moment of thought, more to save face than anything else, he gave a sharp little nod.
What was in the case that you handed over to Shaw at the park?
A Soviet-era RA-115.
Rue wasn't familiar with that designation. It sounded like a weapon, but then again, it really could have been anything.
What is it?
Pachenko eyed him cautiously.
A portable tactical nuclear device. What you in the West used to call a suitcase nuke.
You cannot be serious.
I don't joke when it comes to business. If the fool had come up with another $6 million, I would have been happy to sell him too.
$6 million. The same price paid for the torque. That couldn't be a coincidence. Just what on earth was Shaw up to? Rue had long suspected that Shaw and his Vanguard group were involved in some less than savory activities above and beyond the man's penchant for dealing in the black market artifact trade. Since laying eyes on the case in the back of the Russian's car, Rue envisioned a lot of different items that might be inside. But a tactical nuclear device certainly wasn't one of them. He was almost afraid to ask his next question.
What does he intend to do with it?
Blow something up, I guess. What else do you do with a nuclear bomb? I wish I could see his face when he realizes his plans don't really matter, though.
Why is that?
Because the damn thing's inert. The Soviets took the plutonium out of it years ago. $6 million for a piece of worthless junk.
Rue considered the implications of what he'd just learned. Clearly, his hunch about Shaw was correct. The man was involved in something much more dangerous than artifact smuggling. Just what remained to be seen. Several more questions without real answers let Rue know that he'd mined this particular well dry. He'd also racked up a bill close to $100,000 with his questions. It was a bill he had no intention of paying, of course. He was pretty sure Pachenko knew it as well. The Russian either answered his questions out of the simple desire to screw Shaw over, or he figured he was more likely to live through the experience if he appeared to be cooperating. Rue held no ill will toward the man, and gunning him down for no real reason just didn't seem sporting. But what was he going to do with his two captives? They sat in a sanitized house. Nothing could help the Russian identify them. Everything had been bought secondhand by hired help, themselves hired through other cutouts. The deed belonged to a private trust that went back generations, and the ownership was so tangled it would take years for anyone trying to track him that way to even come close. There was little chance Perchenko would run into him in another setting. They certainly didn't operate in the same circles. Given all that, Rue didn't feel he would be in danger by letting Perchenko go free.
So why am I hesitating?
He didn't have to think too long to realize the RA-115 bothered him. The Russians sold Shaw a nuclear weapon. That it was inoperable didn't matter. The fact he was willing to put a device like that, working or not, in the hands of a man like Shaw, proved he'd do it again if the opportunity arose. Rue wouldn't consider himself a crusader for the greater good, not by a long shot. But the idea of letting this guy back into general circulation just didn't sit well with him. He'd given his word he wouldn't kill him, but that didn't mean that he had to just let him go, with no thought at all to consequences. Getting up, he checked Perchenko's bonds. He then joined Henshaw in the garage, where he was watching over their other captive. Out of earshot of the other man, Rue explained what he wanted his majordomo to do. In short order, Henshaw placed Perchenko and his henchmen in the house basement, where they wouldn't be heard if they called for help. Rue spent the time gathering the tools from the table in the living room and wiping down the surfaces they'd touched while in the house. They made a final sweep through the property to be certain they hadn't missed anything, and they were on their way. Eventually, he knew the Russians would free themselves, particularly if they worked together. It might take a little while, a day, maybe two at the most, but they certainly wouldn't starve to death before getting loose. In the meantime, Rue could give the situation a bit more thought and decide exactly what to do with them. It was actually a decent solution to a rather thorny problem, and as they drove off into the night, Rue felt he had the situation under control. Trevor Jackson gathered seven of his best men together in one of the conference rooms at the Vanguard offices in Paris just after dawn the next morning. Their quarry wasn't due to arrive at the target destination for hours yet, but Jackson wanted to be certain to brief his men thoroughly beforehand. He was out of second chances and knew it. To that end, he'd selected men he'd worked with on jobs in the past, each and every one forged in the crucible of combat. At Shaw's direction, Jackson and his men were to find positions near the geologist's lab where they could observe the examination, then move in to secure the torque once the tests had been completed. Jackson felt it an unnecessary risk to wait. It put them at a greater risk of detection before they could make the snatch, but he wasn't about to argue about it, given his prior failures.
Focus on doing the job. Worry about the rest later.
He used the conference room computer to connect to Google Maps, then pushed the image up onto the screen on the far wall. He zoomed down to street level and was able to give his men an accurate view of the target site.
This is our target location.
It was so much easier than sending a man out with a camera and hoping he got some decent shots of the surrounding area. The screen showed a quiet street lined with old houses converted into office space for lawyers, accountants, and other professionals. Number 4522 stood in the middle of the block, sandwiched between an import-export company and an architectural firm. There was parking on both sides of the street, which eased one of Jackson's concerns. A quick in and out was what they needed, and this would allow for that without difficulty.
All right, here's the drill.
He zoomed back slightly so his team could see the entire building as well as those around it.
We're going in as two units. I want Green and Danvers with me at the front door. Connor, O'Brien, and Driscoll, you've got the back door. There's an alley that runs up behind the buildings here. You can use that to gain access. When you give the signal that you're in place, we'll go in. Michaels and Baker will be our wheelmen. I want the vans positioned here and here.
He indicated positions, one on either side of the road, facing in opposite directions.
If necessary, we'll split up and rendezvous later at the usual location. Our best intelligence indicates there will be two people inside, though there may be more. The first, a geologist, is of no real consequence. I don't expect him to do anything but whimper and die. The other is this woman.
He put a picture of Anya Creed up on the screen.
Yes, 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 she's a looker, I'll give you that. But she's also deadly as a pit viper. She single-handedly defeated both of the teams we've sent after her. I'm not taking any chances this time round. If you see her, put her down. It's that simple. I don't even care how many bullets it takes, just be sure she doesn't get up again.
Jackson looked directly at each man one at a time, making certain they understood his order.
I've yet to see her use a firearm. She prefers to use a sword, of all things. Don't laugh. That blade can kill you as quickly as a bullet. Just ask O'Donnell or Maguire. We've been tasked with recovering an ancient Celtic necklace from the premises.
He put the grainy photograph they'd received from Professor Novick up on the screen for them to see. He wanted everyone to be aware of what it looked like, just in case the geologist, Cartier, or Creed, had a chance to hide it from view.
We won't be claiming responsibility for this strike the way we usually do, but it is an important mission nonetheless. In fact, it is absolutely crucial to a larger mission that'll take place next week, so there isn't any room for failure.
Anya was a few minutes early for her appointment, so she had her cab driver drop her off at a nearby coffee shop, intending to walk the rest of the way on foot. It was a cool, blustery day. It gave her an excuse to slip inside and order a hot chocolate to go. Cup in hand, she continued on her way. Before going to bed the night before, she'd caught the tail end of a press conference on the BBC run by a detective out of New Scotland Yard. He mentioned her name several times, along with the fact that the police were still hoping to speak to her in conjunction with the events at Arkholm. Clearly, she had more than just her enemies looking for her now. Paris lay across the channel and seemed a world away from London. The chances of anyone recognizing her on the street were slim, but she'd still done what she could to disguise her appearance. Most of her publicity shots showed her with her hair down, so she bundled it on top of her head and slapped a baseball cap down over it all. A thick sweater and a baggy pair of jeans hid her trim figure. It wasn't perfect, but it would have to do. Sipping her hot chocolate as she walked along, she admired the morning and the quaint French neighborhood. Anya knocked on Cartier's door right at the appointed time.
Coming.
The door opened to reveal Sebastian Cartier waiting on the other side. There was only one problem. He was gorgeous. He had thick, dark hair hanging in lazy curls in front of his forehead. His eyes sparkled a piercing blue. His smile shone like a 100-watt light bulb. Never mind the broad shoulders covered by a blue t-shirt, or the trim waist and long legs encased in a pair of dark jeans. Anya expected some stuffy academic, someone a lot like Professor Deschamps, actually. Finding Cartier to be not only younger, in his mid-30s was her guess, but so good-looking as well, left her momentarily speechless. Thankfully, Cartier barely noticed, or if he did, he was enough of a gentleman not to let it show. He smiled upon seeing her standing on his stoop.
Miss Creed! What a delight to meet you in person. Please, come inside.
His accent threw her off as well. Who was this guy? She followed him through the small reception area and waiting room that was just inside the front door, and through a door on the left into a well-appointed office that she assumed was his sanctum sanctorum. The walls were lined with bookshelves, and a desk with two soft leather chairs in front of it sat in the center of the room.
Can I get you anything to drink?
She saluted with her hot chocolate.
I'm all set, but thanks.
He waved her into a chair and took the one opposite for himself.
I'm sorry if I sound like a total fanboy, but I can't believe that I have the Anya Creed right here in my living room. I watch your show whenever I'm not out trooping around the field on behalf of one mining organization or another. I really enjoy your mix of archaeology and historical insight. From one scientist to another, you're a credit to our profession.
Thank you, Dr. Cartier. I really appreciate...
Sebastian, please.
She found herself warming to that smile all over again.
Sebastian. And I'm Anya.
Anya it is.
She found her thoughts straying from the torque to how blue Sebastian's eyes were and...
Focus, girl, focus.
What can I do for you, miss... Sorry, Anya. Dr. Duchamp mentioned that you needed to determine the composition of a particular object?
Right.
She explained how they'd found the torque at an Iron Age burial site in Britain,
conveniently leaving out the actual location, in case he'd been watching the news and just hadn't put two and two together yet.
More often than not, torques like this are made of gold, occasionally silver. They were signs of nobility and high status, after all, so you'd expect them to be made of precious materials of one kind or another. But this one is different.
How so?
It's made of a type of metal I've never seen before. Maybe it's something mixed with iron, maybe it's a combination of other elements, I really don't know. Understanding what it is, however, can tell us a lot about the society that produced it.
Cartier was already nodding his head. He understood that archaeology was as much an adventure in guesswork as it was hard science, and that sometimes a single piece of the puzzle, when viewed in the proper light, could make all the difference in piecing the rest of it together in coherent fashion.
I'm assuming you brought the torque with you?
I had it shipped in overnight.
Well, get it out and let's get started.
He led her out of the office, back through the reception area, and down a hallway leading deeper into the building, until they came to what was obviously his working area and laboratory. It reminded her of a college chemistry lab more than anything else. There were several workstations standing like islands throughout the room, and the counters were covered with a variety of equipment and racks of test tubes and various size pipettes. There was an electron microscope along one wall, and what she thought was a squat-looking spectroscope against the other. Sebastian walked over to one of the workstations and spent some time examining the torque, first with his naked eye. He then turned on a bank of high-powered lights and used a series of magnifying glasses.
This is incredible work. I'm astounded by the detail, the intricate strands of this braided metal. My word, look at the eagle head clasps. They're magnificent.
He sat in awe for several minutes.
You say you found this where?
A peat bog in northern Britain.
Any idea when it might have been fashioned?
Anya considered for a moment.
Based on the artifacts discovered with it, we're guessing the burial site was established in the first century, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 AD, give or take a few years. I'd think the torque itself was fashioned in that general time frame as well, though I suppose it could be older. Why?
I'm surprised at the level of craftsmanship, that's all. Most of what I've seen from that time frame, well, it's considerably rougher in nature. Less refined, if you will. Metallurgy techniques were just growing out of their infancy, and the ability to craft hard metal like this was beyond most of the societies I'm familiar with from that era.
I'm listening.
Well, take gold, for instance. It's what we call a soft metal. It's easily workable, even when cold, and extremely malleable. You can force it into pretty much any shape you want, especially when heated.
He pointed to the torque.
Now take this, whatever it is. It's very similar to iron, which means it requires a very high heat to make it malleable and constant attention to get it to do just what you want. Creating a twisted braid with this much detail would be extremely difficult.
Anya was disappointed. She'd hoped for something much more unique.
So you think it's iron or some derivative?
Hey, chin up now. I didn't say it was iron, just that I was guessing it would act like iron. In fact, I don't know what it is. I've never seen anything like it before. Is there anything else you can tell me? Items that might have been near it when it was found, unusual stories or myths involving a torque like this?
Anya hadn't thought it relevant at first, but since he'd asked, she decided to share with him the legend Deschamps told her the day before. When she finished, an astonished Sebastian Cartier sat slack-jawed in front of her.
Oh, why didn't I see it? That makes so much more sense. Damn, I'm an idiot.
Want to fill me in?
As an archaeologist, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that there's often a kernel of truth hidden in the myths and legends passed down to us through history.
Anya nodded. That was certainly true. The ancient city of Troy was a perfect example. Until Schliemann found Troy in 1870, no one believed that Homer's Iliad was anything but fiction.
So, how did the legend put it? The blacksmith fashioned the necklace with the tears of the goddess that he'd collected once they'd fallen to earth, right?
Right.
Sebastian got up from his stool and began pacing back and forth, his excitement rising.
So, just for the sake of argument, let's say that the blacksmith actually did collect something that fell to earth and used it to make the torque. What could that have been? Something that fell to earth.
A meteorite!
Maybe even more than one. That has to be it.
But I thought meteorites were mostly just stone and nickel.
Sebastian waved his hand back and forth in a so-so gesture.
Meteorites fall into three basic categories: stony, stony iron, and iron. They're your basic chondritic meteorites, the kind formed during the early days of the solar system, and as such have the closest relationship to your average Earth rock. These kinds of meteorites are made up of mostly iron with a little nickel and stone thrown in. The easiest way to tell if they are meteorites is to test for the amount of nickel in them. Earth rocks either have a lot of nickel or very little, while the amount of nickel found in a meteorite falls within a very specific range.
But I thought we decided that the torque wasn't made from iron.
We did, and it's not. I'm getting there, just bear with me. Along with chondritic meteorites, we also have achondritic meteorites, the kind that were formed long before the solar system existed. Achondritic meteorites are much more rare and sometimes fall so far out of the usual expectations that we have trouble even classifying them as meteorites. There was one found in Antarctica last year, nothing more than a speck of rock, really. But its chemical composition was so unique that they couldn't conclusively identify it.
So you're suggesting that the blacksmith in the legend found a meteorite, extracted the metal from it, and used that to make the torque?
Yes. It makes sense, doesn't it? You've got this metallic substance that neither of us can identify, which means it's pretty rare. And given the nature of the legend surrounding the necklace, it even makes sense.
So how do we prove it?
Simple, really. We just run a small sample of it through the spectrograph and look at the results.
How small is small?
Just a few grains, that's all.
A few grains? That I can handle.
I say we do it, then.
Sebastian put the torque into a weird-looking device that resembled an enclosed incubator, of all things, and put the torque inside it on a little shelf.
I'm going to shave off a few grains from the outside of the torque with this laser.
He calibrated the device to get the smallest possible beam.
Once we have that, we'll take the resulting sample over to the spectrograph and see what we get.
Good enough for me.
Rue sat enjoying a nice cup of Kenyan coffee the following morning.
Come.
I have that information you asked for, sir.
Henshaw crossed the room, laying a file on Rue's desk. Rue glanced at it, noting its thickness.
Why don't you give me the highlights?
Very good, sir. With respect to the news conference last night, the man's name is Ian Beresford. Detective Inspector Ian Beresford. He's a 20-year veteran of the force, primarily with the Specialist Crime Directorate, handling high-profile cases and working multi-jurisdictional task forces. A few years ago, he was transferred to Special Operations, specifically to the CTC.
Counter-Terrorism Command? That's interesting. Why would someone like that be looking for Anya?
Several nights ago, an archaeological dig site in the West Midlands, just north of Arkholm, was attacked by armed intruders. The local office of the regional police received a call from a woman identifying herself as Ms. Creed. She informed them of the attack and asked for immediate assistance. When the officer in charge tried to obtain more information, the call was abruptly terminated. At first, the call was considered a hoax. Then someone decided to check into the name and discovered Anya's background as a television personality and host. That prompted them to send out a patrol to look into the situation.
And by the time the patrol got there, the intruders were long gone, right?
Yes, sir. To make matters worse, when the patrol arrived, they discovered that the site personnel had been murdered and their bodies dumped in a nearby bog. An initial report incorrectly listed Miss Creed among the deceased, and then later, when it was clear she was not, there was some speculation that she might have been in league with the perpetrators.
The very idea was preposterous, so Rue brushed it aside with barely a thought.
Do we have any idea where she is now?
No, sir, though clearly she is alive. She contacted you twice, and she has apparently been in contact with her producer, Doug Morrell, as well. He held a press conference in New York recently, claiming to have the inside story on exactly what happened at the Arkholm site.
Rue doubted that, doubted it highly. He'd met Doug Morrell and hadn't been all that impressed.
Suspects?
The police haven't released that information. Unofficially, speculations are running rampant, from Al-Qaeda to resurrected bog mummies. The latest reports are...
Did you say bog mummies?
Yes, sir. Oddly enough, the suggestion came out of the press conference Mr. Morrell recently gave in New York. A few of the more liberal news organizations have apparently decided to run with that as their lead theory.
Not to think he said that all with a straight face. I think we can dismiss that possibility, don't you?
Of course. The latest reports out of New Scotland Yard claim that they have several suspects in the case, but they aren't releasing any more information than that. Miss Creed is still wanted by the police, but as a witness rather than as a suspect. There's something else. I'm not sure of its relevance, but it seems like too much of a coincidence to ignore.
Rue raised his eyebrows, indicating Henshaw should continue.
In the first few days following the massacre at the Arkholm site, Detective Inspector Beresford was called out to look at two other homicide scenes, one on the highway south of Arkholm and the other in a run-down hotel on the outskirts of London. There were two bodies recovered from each crime scene, all men in their late 20s or early 30s, all with criminal records of one kind or another. In each case, the men had been identified as alleged members of the Red Hand Defenders, an Irish terrorist group with the goal of freeing Ireland from British rule and oversight.
Do the police consider the three events to be connected in any way?
I'm not entirely sure. My contact inside the MPS didn't want to dig too deeply and risk tipping his hand to anyone who might be watching. But he was able to tell me that at least one individual at each crime scene had been killed with some kind of bladed weapon, most likely a sword. There's also a report from a clergyman who claims to have been saved by a dark-haired angel wielding a holy sword on the highway earlier that afternoon.
Rue sat up, alert. The connection between them all was obvious.
If the Red Hand Defenders are after Anya, it stands to reason they attacked the archaeologist at Arkholm. But what are they after?
That was what was bothering him about this whole scenario. The idea that an Irish terrorist group would have an interest in something unearthed from a peat bog in the middle of...
Mad.
The attack on the archaeological dig was the same night Shaw announced he would auction off a one-of-a-kind Celtic torque he'd recently acquired. If it had been any more obvious, it would have sat up and hit him in the face.
Ah, how could I have missed it? I must get in touch with Anya. Do we have a number for Mr. Morell?
Henshaw nodded.
Let's get him on the phone. Perhaps he knows how to contact Anya.
An hour later, after leaving two voicemails, he finally reached Morell.
Morell?
Hello, Mr. Morell. My name is Rue.
Rue. That's it. Just Rue. Like Prince or Madonna?
Rue gritted his teeth.
No, Mr. Morell, I am nothing like one of your so-called American pop stars. You might remember me as a friend of Anya's.
Yeah, I've heard the name before, but how am I supposed to know it's really you?
Who else would it be?
There are a lot of people looking for Anya right now, Mr. Whoever you are. If you think I'm just going to turn her over to the first person claiming to be a friend of hers, you've got another thing coming.
Do you have caller ID, Mr. Morell?
Of course. Doesn't everyone?
If you do, then you should see that I am calling you from Paris, France. Perhaps you might remember Anya mentioning that is where I lived the last time we met?
That doesn't mean anything. You could be any Joe Blow calling me from France.
That did it.
Why, you little cur! When I get my hands on you, I'll have you whipped and then tied to the back of my horse for an energetic ride around the estate until you'll wish that I'd simply gutted you on the spot! You will help me find Anya!
Hello, Rue. I thought that was you.
If he'd been in the same room with him, Rue probably would have killed him. As it was, he needed a moment to regain control.
Rue? You still there, Rue?
I am. It is urgent that I speak with Anya. Her life may be in danger. Do you have a way of reaching her?
Did you try to call her cell phone?
Rue fought to keep from yelling a second time.
Yes, it seems to be out of operation at the present time.
Oh. Not that cell phone, her other cell phone.
Ah, dear Lord, give me patience. Her other cell phone?
Yeah, she lost the first one when the bog mummies attacked. Or at least that's what we're going to show on the episode. It's going to be incredible. I've already got special effects working out for this full, articulated bog mummy replica that we
Morell!
Can...
The cell phone number?
Oh, right. Hang on. I've got it right here.